which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Janice, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, May 24th issue of the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Watchdog is streamrolled by industries it regulates. Purged agency overseeing prediction and crypto firms, some tied to Trump. Last fall, a high-stakes struggle unfolded inside the red brick walls of an obscure federal agency. Three companies, each with ties to the Trump family's business empire, needed the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to bless their ambitions in the white-hot field of prediction markets. A growing portion of the agency's portfolio, prediction markets, allow Americans to bet on everything from whether the United States will take over Cuba to what color tie that President Trump will wear next. The money-making opportunities were breathtaking, but the company's practices were causing a stir. Senior career officials worried about whether Crypto.com was treating small bettors fairly. They feared that a second firm, Polymarket, did not have strong enough protections against fraud. A third, an offshoot of the crypto firm Gemini, had yet to pass the agency's required review to open for business. Despite these concerns, Carolyn D. Pham, then acting chairman of the commission, and her senior counsel intervened to help the firms get what they wanted, according to people familiar with the situation, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of repercussions. By Christmas, the agency had put two top officials who had raised questions about the companies on leave, barred them from the office, and placed them under internal investigation. Three other senior officials who had enforced laws involving cryptocurrencies, another industry linked to the Trumps, suffered the same fate. None of those officials were told what they had done wrong, but current and former agency staffers said in interviews that the commission's workforce took away a clear message: don't cause trouble for those industries. The suspensions were just one of the many ways in which the CFTC, the primary regulator of a specialized sector of the financial markets, has been mowed down by the powerful business interests it is supposed to oversee, a New York Times investigation found. In the past 16 months of the Trump administration, the commission has shrunk its workforce, purged career officials, sharply curtailed crypto enforcement, and helped out prediction markets at virtually every turn, the Times found. The gutting of the agency is particularly notable because of the Trump family's deep ties to crypto and prediction industries. The Trumps have sold their own digital currencies, generating enormous wealth for the family, while striking deals with prediction market operators as well. The CFTC's transformation has been muscled through by leaders with connections to those industries. Ms. Pham recently left the agency to work for a crypto company that has a partnership with Polymarket. Her senior counsel, Bridget Wyless, was hired by a prediction market company whose application she had helped shepherd. Michael S. Selig, the 36-year-old current chairman, represented crypto firms and worked with prediction markets as a corporate lawyer. A Republican appointed by Mr. Trump, he is now the sole commissioner because the president left all the other board seats vacant. The highly unusual arrangement gives Mr. Selig unilateral authority to file lawsuits and issue new rules as he polices two industries at the center of the president's business empire. President Trump only acts in the best interests of the American public, said Davis Engel, a White House spokesman. There are no conflicts of interest. The agency's pivot is another example of how the Trump administration has bent a previously independent regulatory agency to its will, similar to the changes at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Both commissions now embrace the president's view that regulators have been too punitive towards industry. I've been through an almost equal number of Republicans and Democratic administrations, and there was always a belief you had to have strong enforcement, said Gretchen Lowe, a 30-year agency veteran who retired last year from a top enforcement job. This is really the first time that politics have affected the FCTC in such a dramatic way. Ms. Pham and Ms. Wireless did not respond to requests for comments. But in a public statement last year, Ms. Pham contended that the agency's enforcement division had abused the government's prosecutorial powers. Polymarket said it had strong safeguards, and Crypto.com said it fully abides by all federal regulations. Gemini did not respond to questions. A spokeswoman for the CFTC declined to discuss the treatment of any particular staff members or the agency's handling of specific cases. A weakened CFTC poses risks for millions of Americans who buy crypto or bet on prediction markets, as well as for the broader financial systems with which these new businesses are increasingly intertwined. Both industries have struggled to control fraud and abuse. Crypto schemes are rampant, while insider trading has emerged as a major concern of prediction markets. In an interview, Mr. Selig said that during the Biden administration, the commission had gone overboard, turning minor violations into court cases. He insisted that it was now focused on major wrongdoing and is not playing favorites. If you're committing fraud, manipulation, abuse, insider trading, and our markets, whether it's in crypto or anything else, our enforcement division is watching and will be a cop on the beat, he said. His tough talk belies the agency's track record in the second Trump administration. The CFTC has announced only two cases involving digital currencies. Both were against individual operators accused of fraud, not against more powerful crypto firms. That contrasts with more than 80 such cases brought during the Biden years, either in civil court or administratively. Even during Mr. Trump's first term, before his family turned into a crypto juggernaut, the CFTC announced more than two dozen cases involving crypto. On the prediction market side, the agency has switched from an opponent to an ally in legal battles over how the markets should be regulated. It has announced just one case in the second Trump era against an individual accused of insider trading. The commission, first set up primarily to watch for skullduggery in markets for farm goods like pork bellies, has backed off enforcement just as its responsibilities have rapidly expanded. The CFTC's watchdog role over speculative financial trading already gives it oversight of prediction markets, a booming industry. The two leading platforms took in a total of $50 billion in trades in 2025. This year, they took in that much in just March and April. Now the White House plans to give the agency an even broader portfolio, backing legislation that would hand it more authority over crypto regulation. At the same time, Trump administration cuts have sliced away at the agency's workforce. It was always small for a government office with about 750 employees at its peak in 2015. As of March, it had about 550 employees, fewer since the depths of the 2008 financial crisis. Retreat on crypto. In February 2025, a month after Mr. Trump's inauguration, several CFTC attorneys were enjoying the long President's Day weekend. One was relaxing in the white-painted lodge of a Vermont ski resort. Another was at a classical music performance in New York. Then their phones started buzzing. Their holiday was about to be shredded. The call came from Brian Young, the agency's enforcement director, conveying a directive from Ms. Pham. A former CFTC intern who grew into a skilled networker, Ms. Pham, 45, has moved back and forth between government and the financial industry. President Joseph R. Biden Jr. named her as a commissioner in 2022, when a Republican spot opened up on the bipartisan board. By the time Mr. Trump elevated her to acting chair, she had a reputation as a disruptor and had a habit of posing for friendly photos with executives in the industries her agency polices. Even so, her President's Day fiat was a stunner, seemingly impossible to execute. She wanted the lawyers to drop the agency's lawsuit against a crypto company called KuCoin. It was a big case for the little agency. Under the Biden administration, most cryptocurrencies were regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, which treated them like stocks and bonds traded on Wall Street. But a quirk in how crypto is designed gave the FCTC authority over certain speculative transactions, including trading of Bitcoin, the largest digital currency. In a landmark case, the agency had forced Binance, the world's biggest crypto exchange, to pay $1.35 billion in penalties. KuCoin presented another opportunity to send a message to the markets that it took its crypto oversight seriously. Based on the Seychelles, KuCoin had just agreed to pay nearly $300 million after pleading guilty in a case brought by the Justice Department, which said it had flouted laws designed to catch criminals and prevent illicit transactions. KuCoin had also tentatively agreed to settle charges the CFTC brought against the firm for running an unregistered operation. Ms. Pham did not have the authority to simply kill the case. She needed to enlist a majority of the commission. With two Democratic commissioners still serving, her prospects of that were dim. As a solution, the staff attorneys did the next best thing. They began rewriting the proposed settlement, citing in court an executive order by Mr. Trump that called for a friendlier stance towards crypto. While negotiations with the CFTC were still underway, KuCoin announced last year that it would start offering two new cryptocurrencies created by World Liberty Financial, the Trump family startup crypto venture. The listing of those digital coins was a boost for World Liberty, giving it credibility and access to more customers. The case dragged on, with the FCTC finally settling with KuCoin in March of this year. Its parent company was fined $500,000, a fraction of the multi-million-dollar penalty the agency's attorneys originally expected. In a statement, KuCoin said its decision to offer World Liberty's coins merely reflected the ordinary course of its business and had nothing to do with the charges it faced. A World Liberty spokesman said that many exchanges list its coins. The agency also dropped at least five investigations into other crypto companies, including a late-stage inquiry into a major exchange, according to government documents and former staff members. In the spring of 2025, Ms. Pham's office initiated investigations of three senior enforcement divisions, officials who had worked on various crypto cases, sending a chill through the ranks. Ms. Lowe, the enforcement division's chief counsel and principal deputy, Manuel Sultan, the deputy director, and K. Brent Tomer, the chief trial attorney. The reasons given to them were vague, such as the handling of certain enforcement matters. The agency later ousted Ms. Sultan and Mr. Tomer, citing the administration's effort to shrink the government. Two trial attorneys who had handled crypto cases were demoted. Ms. Lowe left. More than half a dozen former agency officials said in interviews that they believed Ms. Pham deliberately went after crypto attorneys. There was a sustained effort to oust enforcement staff who worked on some of the agency's more significant cryptocurrency matters, said Andrew Rogers, a former trial attorney who resigned last year. Joe Konczewski, a former attorney in the Chicago office, said he was ordered twice to shutter investigations of crypto operators before his job was eliminated last summer. The FCTC has said to bad actors in the crypto space that it is not coming after them, he said. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times. The president himself. The agency retreated from crypto enforcement came too late for Gemini. In January 2025, just before a scheduled trial, the company agreed to pay $5 million fine to settle charges that it had misled CFTC staff members about a Bitcoin auction. But Gemini appears to have escaped other possible consequences from that case. The firm's founders, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, are presidential favorites. They are political donors, White House ballroom contributors, investors in a private club party owned by Donald Trump Jr., the president's eldest son, and financial backers of a crypto firm co-founded by another son, Eric Trump. Without admitting wrongdoing, Gemini pledged as part of its court settlement not to publicly assert that the charges against it were groundless. Yet 5 months later, it filed a complaint with the CFTC's Inspector General attacking the case and the attorneys behind it. Tyler Winklevoss posted the complaint on X, declaring, "These lawyers misuse their offices and millions of taxpayer dollars to engage in trophy-hunting lawfare against Gemini to advance their careers." By at least one account, the Winklevoss twins did not stop there, but used their complaint to influence who ultimately led the agency. After putting Ms. Pham temporarily in charge, Mr. Trump, in February 2025, selected Brian Quintenz, a former commissioner and a board member of a prediction market company, to lead the agency. But Mr. Quintenz said on social media in September that his nomination foundered because he refused to promise that he would support Gemini's complaint against the agency. Mr. Quintenz released what he said were private texts in which Tyler Winklevoss insisted he treat Gemini complaints as the highest priority, and said he would be happy to raise this issue with the president himself. Mr. Quintenz wrote that after he balked, the Winklevoss twins complained about him to Mr. Trump. The end of September, the president pulled Mr. Quintenz's nomination. A representative for Gemini declined to comment on the text at the time. A White House spokesman said the president nominates America First patriots that are aligned with his agenda. Mr. Selig declined to comment on Gemini's complaint. Interventions. Gemini had more asks coming. Its affiliate, Gemini Titan, had been trying to break into prediction markets since 2020, but had failed to win FCTC approval. Last year, Gemini re-upped its application. In December, agency employees were in the middle of an examination of Gemini's submission when they were presented with an unusual document. It was a draft memo sent by Ms. Wiles, recommending that the application be approved. Typically, staff members write such recommendations, then forward them to the commissioners, not the other way around, and the review was still underway. The application was swiftly approved. It was one of three times in quick succession that Ms. Pham and Ms. Wiles intervened on the side of a prediction market companies doing business with the Trump family, according to the people familiar with the situation. Crypto.com already had an authorized prediction market by the start of Mr. Trump's second term. But a brief notice in one of the company's public filings had caught some agency staff members' attention. They worried that the firm was giving large trading companies a leg up over ordinary sports bettors without fully disclosing the practice. Ms. Pham and Ms. Wiles discouraged them from pursuing the matter, then cut them out of discussions with the firm, people familiar with the case said. Officials for Crypto.com declined to comment on its discussions with the CFTC. They said the firm was upfront about its practice, had a level playing field, and kept its disclosures in place. Crypto.com is a close business partner of Trump Media and Technology Group, a publicly traded company in which the president is the largest shareholder. Among other agreements, Crypto.com and Trump Media struck in October what they described as an executive deal to work together on a prediction market. Trump Media did not respond to a request for comment. Perhaps the most consequential case involved Polymarket, which had been in and out of trouble with the agency for several years. In 2022, the firm paid a $1.4 million fine to the CFTC for taking bets from Americans without the agency's permission. Those accusations resurfaced in November 2024 after a surge of betting on the U.S. election. The FBI raided the New York apartment of its founder, Shane Copeland. The CFTC also pursued an inquiry. The Trump administration dropped both investigations in July. That month, Polymarket bought a licensed company, allowing it to open a new platform for American customers. Nevertheless, the firm's ambitions hit a snag when it sought the commission's permission to take bets through intermediaries. While that leeway could get the company more customers, it could also enable someone illegally inside information to cloak bets and escape detection. In August, Polymarket announced an infusion of funds from 1789, an investment firm owned partly by Donald Trump Jr. Polymarket also named him an unpaid advisor. A spokesman for Donald Trump Jr. said he had no involvement in Polymarket's dealings with federal regulators. In the fall, amid a roughly six-week government shutdown, the CFTC officials summoned staffers to work on Polymarket's request. At a November meeting with the company, Rahul Verma, the acting director of the Market Oversight Division, and Rachel Bardonsky, the deputy director for compliance, raised questions about the strength of Polymarket's anti-fraud protections. Ms. Wiles, in a departure from the usual practice, attended the examination. About the same time that Polymarket got approval, the agency placed Ms. Bardonsky on administrative leave and under investigation. She is now retired. By the end of the year, Mr. Verma, too, was culled. It was his predecessor, Vince McConagall, who was working on a different office, but had held up Gemini's application the year before while he headed the unit. After he was placed on leave, he left the agency. So did dozens upon dozens of others. The agency workforce shrank by about a quarter last year, the biggest annual drop in at least two decades. Despite the cuts, the CFTC spokeswoman said the agency has resources sufficient to fulfill our mandate. Ms. Pham and Ms. Wiles also moved on, taking jobs in industries the agency regulates. Both of them followed federal ethic rules, a senior CFTC official said. In March, Ms. Wiles started work as general counsel for Gemini Titan, the same company for which she had intervened. Ms. Pham left the chair's office in December to join MoonPay, a crypto company that has its own prediction market aspirations. It had already announced an exclusive partner in that endeavor, Polymarket. A new reality. When he arrived in December, Mr. Selleck found himself alone at the top. After the other commissioners left last year, Mr. Trump appointed only Mr. Selleck as a replacement, leaving the rest of the seats vacant. That dismantled the system of checks and balances that once governed the CFTC and handed the new chairman sweeping authority to reshape the agency. Not long after starting the job, he embarked on a speaking tour, appearing at industry conferences and on tech podcasts, where he has complained about fake news and called prediction markets truth machines that generate more accurate information. He has sided with the crypto industry in high-stakes policy disputes and sued several states that attempted to regulate sports wagering on prediction markets. In his interview with The Times, Mr. Selig vowed that he would also revitalize the enforcement division. "We're hiring," he said. Yet the administration asked for only 3 additional enforcement employees from last year's budgeted total of 105. At the same time, the White House is pushing to give the agency more authority over crypto, shifting power away from the SEC, which has 7 times the staff. Even the CFTC's highest profile enforcement effort this year shows how its priorities appear to be shifting. Last month, the Justice Department and the CFTC charged a U.S. Special Forces soldier with using classified information to bet on Polymarket about the ouster of Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, an operation the soldier himself was involved in. Mr. Selig touted it as evidence that the CFTC would vigilantly police the industry. Buried in the indictment, however, was an important detail. The soldier had placed the wagers on Polymarket's international platform, which the firm promised to wall off from U.S. customers when it settled with the agency in 2022. While it didn't specify his location, the indictment noted that he had logged onto Polymarket using an internet tool that the company said it bans. Joseph A. Grunfest, a Stanford Law School professor who has written about prediction markets, said that federal authorities should be investigating the company and its practices, not just prosecuting the soldier. "Usually when you find one ant, there are going to be more," he said. When the soldier was charged, Mr. Copland, Polymarket's founder, said that the firm had flagged this, referred it, and cooperated throughout the process. The CFTC spokeswoman declined to comment on whether the agency was investigating Polymarket. But on his speaking tour, Mr. Selig has alluded to Mr. Copland's battles with regulators. In March, he was a keynote speaker at an event in Washington organized by the Digital Chamber, a trade group that advocates for crypto firms and prediction markets. In front of a packed auditorium, Mr. Selig was interviewed on stage by Teresa Goody Glillan, a personal lawyer from Chenpeng Zhao, the crypto billionaire who founded Binance and paid $150 million in penalties to the CFTC in 2023. Mr. Selig rallied against regulating by enforcement and singled out the example he viewed as especially egregious, Polymarket. "Law enforcement went so far as to raid the home of a founder," Mr. Selig declared. "Thankfully, we live in a new reality today." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Floridians ship staples to aid Cuban kin hurt by blockade. Demand intensifies as energy crisis grows. This article is by David C. Adams, Andrea Zerait, and David Ovelle. Miami, People in Cuba are enduring food shortages, near constant blackouts, and suffocating heat. For many, the only relief comes in packages from relatives hundreds of miles away in Miami. As the island nation faces economic collapse under the U.S. oil blockade, South Floridians are rushing to ship boxes stuffed with canned meats, bags of rice and beans, and other staples to hungry relatives. They are also sending mosquito nets, flashlights, fans, and loose-fitting nightgowns for coping with insufferable nights. Some pay off the book couriers known as mulas or mules, who fly to Cuba to deliver goods or envelopes of American cash. George Smith, 64, who left Cuba for Miami 4 years ago, has been shopping for a stronger solar-powered generator for his daughter and her 5-year-old son in Havana. With electricity ever more fleeting, the 60-watt machine he bought and shipped them months ago no longer suffices. "They only have 2 hours grid power a day," said Mr. Smith, an Uber driver who, like many Cuban Americans, struggles to pay his own bills and in increasingly unaffordable Miami. While he is deeply opposed to the Cuban government, Mr. Smith doesn't agree with the blockade. "By cutting off the oil, they cut off the life of the people," he said. "It's the people who suffer. Cubans have long relied on relatives in the United States, who today can turn to informal couriers, multiple shipping companies in Miami, and Amazon-style shopping sites that arrange deliveries to the island. But demand has intensified as Cuba's communist government struggles to contain a catastrophic energy crisis. The island has all but run out of fuel for local transport, and its aging power stations are unable to keep its electric grid running. Oil shipments from Venezuela, Cuba's longtime benefactor, were already dwindling before the Trump administration captured the Venezuelan leader, Nicolas Maduro, in January and asserted control over the nation's oil industry. To pressure the Cuban government into collapse, the Trump administration then imposed a de facto blockade, barring all foreign oil from reaching the island. Cuban officials announced last week that its fuel oil supplies had been completely depleted. As part of its pressure campaign, the Trump administration on Wednesday announced it had secured an indictment against Raul Castro, the nation's former leader, for his suspected role in the fatal downing of 2 planes piloted by Cuban exiles. Food for sale in both state and private-owned Cuban stores has long been exorbitantly priced, said Michael J. Bustamante, a University of Miami historian who specializes in Cuban affairs. "If you're in a position to have family members on the outside that can try to get you stuff, you already have a big leg up on a big chunk of the Cuban population," said Dr. Bustamante, whose family recently helped arrange delivery of a wheelchair to an older relative with dementia. "Yet Cuban Americans find themselves in a delicate position. Many support President Trump's pressure campaign, even as their families turn to wood charcoal to cook, now that blackouts are far more frequent. I don't want my son to suffer, but if that's the only way to be free, well, I have to put up with it so that Cuba can be free," said Tanya Lombard, 66, who came to Miami from Cuba nearly 2 decades ago. She and her husband recently sent 105 pounds of beans, canned ground beef and powdered milk to her adult son. The goods were shipped through Cubamax, a Florida chain that also serves as an online supermarket, travel agency, and remittance company. Such businesses are contentious in Miami. They have described themselves as vital to delivering the type of humanitarian aid permitted under the decades-old U.S. embargo, which prohibits most exports to Cuba. The new oil blockade briefly disrupted the company's deliveries on the island this winter, but they resumed after the Trump administration began allowing private businesses to procure their own fuel. Some Cuban Americans, including a number of elected officials, have criticized the companies, arguing that their business helps prop up the island's communist regime, and that the goods they ship include luxury items prohibited by law. Using those services means supporting the regime, said Lazaro Campos, 42, who instead buys plane tickets for friends to visit Cuba with goods packed in long black duffel bags known as gusanos or worms. Cubamax executives did not respond to several requests for comment. In South Florida, Mr. Campos scrapes by on whatever jobs he can muster. Handyman, construction worker, delivery driver. He supports three children in Cuba. One, a 17-year-old who said that his school had stopped providing food and that classrooms had become unbearable without fans. Mr. Campos also sends medicines for his elderly mother, who relies mostly on rainwater to drink and bathe after her town's water pump broke. She lives in Isla de la Juventud, an island province where ferries delivered supplies have been cut back because of the lack of fuel oil. Mr. Campos' living conditions aren't easy either. He can't afford rent, so he sleeps in his white Mitsubishi SUV or crashes with friends. For Ivis Cladira, the soaring price of gas has crimped her ability to send cash every week to her parents in the Matanzas province. She drives about 20 miles each way between her apartment, Hialeah, outside Miami, and her job at a casino at Hallandale. She earns less than $11 an hour, or minimum wage for servers in Florida. On a recent afternoon outside a Cubamax in Hialeah, Miss Cladira was sending sterile syringes to Havana so her mother can inject her blood circulation medication. In Havana, her parents have virtually no electricity, but she doesn't want to invest in solar panels to send them, as other Cuban Americans have done. It's too expensive, she said. Besides, I'm hoping communism will fall soon. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In dissecting 24 laws, Democrats report ignores Gaza and Biden's age, by Lisa Lehrer and Tim Balk. The nearly 200-page draft of an internal autopsy of the 2024 presidential election released by the Democratic National Committee this past week was more notable for the subjects it didn't tackle than for what it did. The document, which was littered with blank pages, factual inaccuracies, and bright red disclaimers, omitted some of the hottest button issues of the race. and it made clear that the party had failed to take advantage of the retrospective exercise to grapple fully with the factors that caused Kamala Harris to lose to Donald J. Trump. Whether that was by design is unclear. Party leaders distanced themselves from the report as they unveiled it, releasing a statement saying it does not meet our standards. Some critics were quick to jump. It's just a perfect metaphor for the failures of the National Democratic Party, said Zach Walls, a Democratic Senate candidate in Iowa, who said he got a question about the report at an event on Thursday evening. You can't even complete a review of why you lost an election, and then you wonder why you keep losing elections. Mr. Walls called for Ken Martin, the party's embattled chairman, to resign. It's time to burn it all down and start all over. There are five issues the DNC autopsy ignored. The war in Gaza. An early news report from Axios, which prompted interest in the autopsy, claimed that the report concluded that Ms. Harris, the former vice president, lost significant support from voters in her presidential run because of the Biden administration's approach to the war in Gaza. But in the end, the report made no mention of Israel or Gaza, an issue that has fractured the party. Former President Joseph R. Biden Jr. and then Ms. Harris were dogged by pro-Palestinian protesters who objected to their support for Israel, including some who encouraged liberal voters to boycott Mr. Biden during the primary. Ignoring that issue was a major omission, according to numerous Democratic officials and candidates. Survey after survey shows the Democratic base eager to take a more oppositional stance to Israel, with nearly half of all Democrats describing their party as too supportive of Israel. It's obvious to any observer of American politics that Gaza was a huge issue in the 2024 election. And to not confront it is exactly what led to the establishment losing, said Representative Ro Khanna of California, who warned party leaders during the 2024 campaign that their stance would cost them votes. What the establishment wants is for the issue to go away, but it's not going away. Biden's age. It's hard to analyze the 2024 campaign without addressing Mr. Biden's age and mental acuity. Yet these issues were not mentioned in the draft report. Amanda Littman, the head of Run for Something, which recruits young progressives to seek office, said Mr. Biden's age was a huge reason behind her party's defeat, and that has fueled continued mistrust. Not to mention it at all as even a factor, she said, shows not seriously engaging with reality. The former president, who would have been 86 at the end of a second term, was dogged by questions about his mental and physical fitness to serve from the early weeks of his presidency. There was plenty of evidence that voters saw his age as a significant concern. As early as March 2024, polling showed a majority of voters who supported Mr. Biden in 2020 believed he was too old to lead the country effectively. But the report does not address the factors that led the party to mostly fall behind his decision to run for a second term. In the end, it was his halting and disjointed performance in the debate that transformed concerns about his age into his final political liability, forcing his departure from the race. After Biden left race, once Mr. Biden dropped out of the presidential race, the party quickly coalesced around Miss Harris. She took control of Mr. Biden's enormous political operation, formally renamed the Harris for President campaign, and got immediate access to his campaign war chest and staff. The report did not wrestle with whether this was the right approach. At the time, some party officials had suggested that holding an open convention would have allowed for more vetting and produce a stronger candidate. But Democratic leaders instead leaned into unity. Economic issues. Throughout the 2024 race, voters consistently rated economic issues and cost of living as a top concern. But Democrats struggled to talk about that issue in a way that resonated. Mr. Biden yoked his campaign to the virtues of Bidenomics, an argument that failed to resonate with voters concerned about higher costs. When Ms. Harris became the nominee, she initially focused on proposals that would have a direct impact on costs. But in the final week, she pivoted to attacking Mr. Trump as a grave risk to the country's democratic foundations. None of that recent history, or now the failure to address economic concerns in the contest, broadly hurt Ms. Harris' campaign, is deeply addressed in the report. Howard Dean, a former chair of the DNC and a 2024 presidential candidate, said the report was a piece of junk and was focused on inside the Beltway questions rather than what he said was the most important issue, the party's approach to policy in 2024. The analysis of the shortcomings of Ms. Harris' campaign was fine, Mr. Dean said, but the report failed to grapple with why people don't believe the Democrats have their economic interests at heart. Going on Rogan. If the refrain of many Democrats after losing the 2026 presidential race was that Hillary Clinton should have gone to Wisconsin, for some after 24 was that Ms. Harris should have gone on Rogan. In the final days of the 2024 race, Mr. Trump appeared on Joe Rogan's hugely popular podcast, and Ms. Harris chose not to, a decision viewed by critics as a reflection of an overly cautious campaign that failed to embrace the growing power of podcasts and influencers. Mr. Trump was richly rewarded by his appearance. Not only did it haul in tens of millions of views, but Mr. Rogan endorsed Mr. Trump on the eve of the election. Ms. Harris said later she regretted that she had not gone on. But there was no discussion of the decision or the Harris campaign's broader approach to podcasts anywhere in the draft report. Last week's top trending headlines. Trump administration updates. House pulls vote to halt Iran war. House Republicans on Thursday abruptly canceled a vote on a resolution directing President Trump to withdraw U.S. forces from Iran or win approval from Congress to continue the war. They lacked the votes to defeat the measure. The treat was a striking setback that exposed fractures within the GOP over the conflict, Megan Maniero, Robert Jimison, and Michael Gold reported from the Capitol. The Iran war is crippling one of the world's wealthiest nations. River Akira Davis wrote about the effects of the war on Qatar. Iranian attacks and the stoppage of seaborne transit have paralyzed Qatar's vital gas exports, from which the country derives more than 60% of its revenue. Even if the Strait of Hormuz were to open tomorrow, it would take the country years to return to its pre-war output. Representative Thomas Massey, frequent Trump critic, is ousted in Kentucky primary. Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky, a Republican who frequently clashed with the president, lost to a Trump-backed challenger in the state's primary on Tuesday. Mr. Massey ran a robust and defiant campaign in a race that became the most expensive House primary in recent history. Ed Gehring, the retired Navy SEAL who defeated Mr. Massey, has vowed to do whatever Mr. Trump asks of him when he arrives in Congress next year. Experimental drug yields dramatic weight loss. An experimental shot called retatrutide appeared to be the most powerful yet in a wave of medications that have transformed the treatment of obesity. People who received injections lost 28% of their body weight on average after 80 weeks, Eli Lilly said. A sort of a souped-up GLP-1 retatrutide affects three hormones that help control appetite, energy balance, and metabolism. Gina Collada and Rebecca Robbins reported. Woman dies after falling into open manhole in Manhattan. Danik Gokash, 56, died after plunging 10 feet into an uncovered utility hole when she stepped out of her vehicle in Midtown Manhattan. Con Edison said video footage suggested the manhole cover was dislodged when a truck drove over it 12 minutes earlier. She took a couple of steps and just vanished. A witness said it happened so quickly. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from May 24th issue of the front section of the New York Times. We read from the front section of the New York Times every Sunday at 1 p.m. Your reader has been Janice. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the New York Times opinion page. Following that at 3 o'clock, the New York Times Arts and Leisure. And at 4 o'clock, a rebroadcast of this morning's Buffalo News. Radio Reading mails out a large print program schedule to our listeners every other month. If you have not received a Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service large print program schedule in the mail, please call us at 716-821-5555. We will make sure that you receive one every other month. A Braille version of the schedule is also available upon request. Our number again is 716-821-5555. Thank you. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which may